I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. It's just over a week until Election Day, and Senators John McCain and Barack Obama are focusing on many of the states that went to President Bush in 2004. Florida, Virginia, North Carolina, and the two states where both candidates are campaigning today, Ohio and Pennsylvania. Obama is calling on voters to, quote, turn the page on the policies of the Bush administration, and McCain is warning that Obama's policies would, quote, destroy business and keep the stock market in decline. The latest ABC News Washington Post poll finds Obama leading McCain 52-45%. Joining us is Rick Klein. He's senior political reporter with ABC News. And Rick, we're in the home stretch. What can we expect in the next week?
This is closing argument time, which means that you sort of make a final pitch to voters. It's hard to put any kind of a new line of attack out there because it's so close to Election Day. But the candidates do what they can do, but most of this now is going to be settled by things on the air and on the ground. The ad wars that are continuing with millions of dollars being spent in the battleground states and the infrastructure in place to get voters to the polls. And by most accounts on both of those measures, Barack Obama has a significant advantage. So that puts some pressure on John McCain. He's talking today a little bit about taxes and about divided government and the need to have checks and balances in government, kind of a final argument from him that ties together a bunch of the different strings that he's been discussing.
So no October surprise.
Well, so far, I guess we've got 4 days left in October for a surprise, and I wouldn't rule out a November surprise either. We're definitely at a stage in the campaign where what the candidates do is secondary to outside events. We've seen that already with the stock market collapse and the turmoil in the economy, and we could very easily see that again with some kind of an unexpected event, which by their nature are unexpected.
As we said, the focus today is Ohio and Pennsylvania, and in Pennsylvania in particular, it's gone blue, really, in the last four elections, and polls show that Obama has a significant lead there. But McCain is still digging his heels in there. What's happening in Pennsylvania?
That is McCain's best and only shot at flipping one of the big blue states. And he's behind very significantly in the polls. So it's got a lot of people scratching their heads about that one and wondering why it is that he thinks he has a chance there. I think if he's able to carry Pennsylvania, it gives him so much more margin for error. If he loses Pennsylvania, it becomes very difficult. He's got to run the table across the rest of the country. Pennsylvania is an area, as you mentioned, has been more Democratic in the voting rolls, although there's some thought that voters in parts of the state may be having racist tendencies and feeling uncomfortable with an African-American candidate on the Democratic side. So all of those things give Republican at least some hope and some chance in Pennsylvania, but it is a remote chance by any measurement I've seen Barack Obama in control in Pennsylvania and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. And how about Ohio? Also very tight there. Ohio was the state that sealed the deal for Bush in 2004, and of course Hillary or Rodham Clinton took that state during the presidential primary. So what does it look like there?
A dead heat. A consortium of newspapers put together a poll over the weekend that had it as a 3-point edge for Barack Obama, which is a little bit narrower than it's been. If Barack Obama is able to win Ohio, he basically wins the presidency because you figure along with Ohio goes Pennsylvania and then we're done. Those two in Florida are the biggest battleground states out there and have been for the last couple of elections. If you win two out of three of those, it's hard to lose. Barack Obama has more of a chance, though, by carrying only one out of those three. If he were to carry two or all three, then he almost certainly would be the next president.
You know, we heard from David Frum, the former Bush speechwriter, who called on Republicans to divert money away from McCain's campaign to the Senate races to try to minimize losses there. How is that message playing out?
Not well in the McCain world. They're not happy to see this go at all. And there's a split even among smart Republicans, some who continue to think John McCain does have a chance here and that these Senate races are going to rise or fall on McCain's fortunes. At the top of the ticket is the best thing you can do. We saw a little of this happen in 1996 when it was clear that Bob Dole wasn't going to be victorious. He focused his campaign's efforts even on states that could help Republican senators and at least maintain some kind of a bulwark against the Clinton agenda. There's a big argument for that now going on in the Republican Party that an Obama presidency with an emboldened majority in the House and the Senate is going to be almost unstoppable and that they should do what they can to maintain at a minimum 41 senators, which is the amount that you need to mount a filibuster. But the prospects are very poor in both the House and the Senate. We could really be talking about a huge wave of the night for the Democrats.
So what are the key things you're going to be looking at this week, Rick?
A few things. The closing messages, obviously. What are they saying in the final hours and final days? Do we have any new sharp attacks, anything off the wall? Outside groups have been totally silent, almost silent, I should say, for most of this campaign. Does someone come in with a big media buy-in, something splashy, and say something outrageous? that could get some traction at the end. And finally, where are the candidates spending their time? There are so few days left right now. You know exactly where the map is. So the decisions that they make take on a greater importance. And if Barack Obama is playing only offense, that says a lot about his campaign's confidence. And if John McCain is playing only defense in Bush carried states, that speaks, I think, quite a bit to where his campaign stands.
Speaking of big media buy, isn't Obama addressing the nation Wednesday night?
He is. That's right. A half an hour on the major networks. Blocked coverage. Nothing like this has happened since at least 1992 when Ross Perot did it. This is a closing argument that Obama can make directly to the country. We'd expect him to appear as presidential as possible to talk about the economy and the big issues that face the country. The other is he can do this because he's got an insane amount of money. I mean, just a level of fundraising, probably $750 million he'll end up raising through the course of this campaign. It shatters every record known to man in this country. So it is an astounding amount of money, and it gives him this kind of flexibility to compete everywhere and then to do something like this, which is to go up in a high-profile, splashy way a week before the election.
And how does the McCain campaign respond to something like that?
I don't know how you do. I mean, I think they can say, look, you know, here he is, a celebrity. He wrote that campaign finance pledge, and he's going out and saying what he's saying. But there's no way that they can even begin to compete financially with that kind of a media buy.
Well, Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News, thanks so much for being with us, Rick.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Conservative columnist Bill Kristol today writes that John McCain needs to shift his campaign message back to the war in Iraq. McCain has said his views on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were shaped by the Vietnam War, both as a prisoner of war there and by his father's service as commander of Pacific Forces. Senator McCain has criticized his father, Admiral John McCain, for not speaking out publicly against the White House in its Vietnam strategy. And newly released White House tapes show that the Nixon administration was concerned about Admiral McCain as well. For more about that and about how McCain's views of war have been shaped by his father, we turn to Michael Cranish of the Boston Globe. And Michael, remind us of Admiral McCain's role in promoting the Vietnam War.
Well, John McCain's father was a big cheerleader for the Vietnam War. He gave a lot of briefings that he was famous for giving, in which he painted out a very rosy picture of how the war was going. Year after year, he would say that victory's around the corner, when in fact, privately, he had reservations about how the war was being waged. And what's interesting is that these White House tapes that have not gotten a lot of publicity in this particular segment until now, they show that Nixon was at first very supportive of Admiral McCain, his commander of Pacific Forces in Vietnam. But Admiral McCain became concerned that he did not have enough latitude to bomb in North Vietnam, by the way, where his son was being held. So long story short, Admiral McCain complained that he wanted more leeway, and Nixon got very angry. And there are White House tapes in which basically Nixon expresses his anger about Admiral McCain.
We do have a bit of that tape right now. It's a little rough to hear, but we can listen to some of it. It's a tape of Richard Nixon from May of 1972, and he was lashing out at McCain about bombing in North Vietnam. And let's listen. This is President Nixon. The tape is difficult to hear, but that's President Nixon saying that military leaders have restricted themselves and they are the ones who won't bomb in North Vietnam. And he also goes on to say that he wants Admiral McCain to stay on the job. So tell us what happened, Michael Cranish.
Well, there's a lot going on behind the scenes. Nixon did come around and think that there should be bombing in North Vietnam. Admiral McCain thought his restrictions were still too great. And Admiral McCain shortly thereafter did go into retirement. Nonetheless, publicly, he continued to put a very rosy face on how things were going on the Vietnam War. This was in 1972 during Nixon's reelection campaign. And Admiral McCain wrote a pretty famous op-ed in the New York Times in which he said, the Vietnamization strategy is working well. That's the strategy in which the U.S. would turn over the war basically to the South Vietnamese. And as Senator McCain later said, his father knew that this strategy, in fact, was not going well and, in fact, led to the loss of the war in Vietnam. What makes this so relevant today is that a lot of these things sound pretty similar if you look at what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan. While those wars are certainly different than Vietnam, there's the same basic question of what will happen when the U.S. turns the war over to local forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. And John McCain has said he learned these lessons of Vietnam very well. It's why he backed the surge. It's why he says he does not want to set a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. forces in Iraq, for example, because he remembers what happened in Vietnam. So this is an overlay to Senator McCain's thinking, his conflict with his father, his conflict with what happened during the Vietnam War, as it applies to policies in Iraq and Afghanistan.
What about in terms of John McCain's persona, if you will? What about his anger at his father for not speaking out publicly about this and only saying privately that he disagreed with the Nixon White House? Do we see any evidence of how Senator John McCain's anger at his father might be playing out?
Right. There's no question he loved and respected his father in general. In this particular area, though, he was very upset. And he basically said his father should have resigned in protest. He said his father should not have put career first instead of country first. And what's striking is that if you read the things that McCain has written about his father, it resonates today in Senator McCain's campaign when he talks about straight talk. You can certainly see the inference that he thinks his father should have given straight talk back in 1972 about how the Vietnam War strategy was failing and country first and maverick and so forth. All of those things, certainly, you can see today. And from my reporting, I think there's a direct correlation.
Sins of the father.
Well, he titled his autobiography Faith of My Fathers, but in that same book, he does spell out some pretty strong disagreements. And since the book is overall such a warm portrait of his father and grandfather, it's easy to miss that. But if you go back and look where he says that the entire senior command of the armed forces, including his father, shirked their duty to resign in protest over Washington's management of the war. That's a direct quote. He said his father knew the strategy of the war was, quote, grievously flawed. And then he wrote, obviously, my father was implicitly included in that indictment. So he was pretty direct in being critical of his father there.
Do you think, then, that Senator McCain is more willing to listen to military leaders, perhaps, because of this experience as well?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, given what his father experienced with Richard Nixon, it's just like McCain and when he talked about President Bush not having the right strategy of the Vietnam War. I mean, here's a leading U.S. senator, veteran, criticizing President Bush during a time of war. It's not the typical thing you expect. But from my reporting, I think it's directly related to his father's failure to do so with President Nixon. I mean, McCain talks a lot about faith, duty, country, and putting country first and not putting your career first. And, you know, during the campaign, McCain said time and again, I'd rather lose an election than lose a war. So I think he is translating those events of Vietnam and his father into the way he operates today in that statement.
Did you talk with Senator McCain about this?
For this story, I've talked to him many times over many years. For this particular story, they did not want to have him talk to me for whatever reason, and not surprisingly, since, you know, it goes into some of these disagreements. And frankly, I don't know if Senator McCain is aware of these tapes in which Nixon talks about his father and himself. There's one point at which Nixon says, you know, Admiral McCain's got a son who's a POW, and he goes into that. And these tapes, although the recordings were made, obviously, a very long time ago, what's interesting is a lot of the Nixon-era tapes are still coming out. Many tapes have not been transcribed, and I've sort of made a side career, if you will, of going back and looking at, you know, what's in these tapes relevant to today. 4 years ago, I wrote about what Nixon said about John Kerry, and I've written about what Nixon said about Romney and his father and so forth. And there's a lot of, it's amazing, there's so much relevance in that history still to today. And in fact, there's more tapes that have not been released coming out in a couple of months. So these are a never-ending source of material.
All right. Well, good luck transcribing.
Thank you so much.
It's Michael Cranish of the Boston Globe. To hear those Nixon White House tapes we mentioned, go to our website, here-now.org. Just ahead, a former Marine turned college president urges returning veterans to consider higher education. It's Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. On November 10th, 2004, a photograph on the front page of the New York Times showed a determined young Marine carrying his rocket launcher into the Battle of Fallujah in Iraq. 3 hours after that photo was taken, the Marine, Lance Corporal Samuel Crist, lay wounded. A bullet in his right arm, another bullet lodged in his left leg, and his future in limbo. Around the same time, James Wright, a former Marine who is now president of Dartmouth College in New Hampshire, was visiting wounded vets, urging them to go back to school. Among the veterans he met was Samuel Crist, who is now in his second year at Dartmouth. And Samuel, James Wright is sitting next to you in the studio at Dartmouth right now, but let's start with you and your decision to take his advice and apply to Dartmouth. You did so cautiously. What was it like when you first got there?
I was really nervous. It's very surreal coming from a lifestyle where everything's very practical and pragmatic, and there are real consequences for everything that you do. And then now in the academic world, you're allowed to explore in depth different ideas and ideologies. The transition was huge. It was tremendous.
Mm-hmm. Samuel, it's my understanding that you have bracelets on your wrist to remember some of your friends who died in Iraq, and you also have tattoos that display your military background. How do you think the students react to that overall?
The reactions vary. Some people are surprised when they find out that I also have that other part of my life before coming here. It makes some people uncomfortable. But by and large, the vast majority of the students, it doesn't seem to be a barrier.
Mm-hmm. You're obviously a very serious student. I imagine that it could be difficult at times to be in a dorm, say, with someone who's 18 or 19 years old and hasn't had the experiences that you have.
It can be interesting at times, yes, ma'am.
So, President Wright, what prompted you to start all of this?
Well, it was actually the Battle of Fallujah, I think. Which when I read the accounts of that and followed it, I was just so struck by the suffering and the sacrifice and the courage of these young Marines. I knew the casualty figures were very high, and a friend who was a retired Marine officer suggested I go down to the hospital, and he helped to arrange with the commandant's office permission for me to go. And I think I saw Samuel on maybe my second or third trip.
Bethesda is very close to Washington, D.C., so there were a lot of political officials as well as just motivated civilians that wanted to come in and show their support. And one of the people that came in was President Wright. He came in and he was talking about getting people back into college, seeing what our plans were for the future, and passing around his business card, asking if he could help.
You were talking to Samuel before about his reception here, and I hope that his reception is always a warm and a welcoming one. And I do think it's important to note that even though obviously there is significant opposition in this country, a negative attitude toward the war in Iraq, as there was in the war in Vietnam, I think there's, as somebody who was here during the last stages of the Vietnam War as well, there's just a significant difference. Nobody faults the young men and young women who have been in the military in Iraq for the war. If anything, I think we admire them for it. They're not suffering the way their fathers did when they came back from Vietnam, and I think that's a very positive and important thing for us nationally to remember that.
Mm. And this is your second year, is that correct, Samuel?
Yes, ma'am. It's my second year here, or the beginning of my second year here, and I had a year of school in Houston before I transferred, and a semester of school in Louisiana before I enlisted.
Mm-hmm. So can you tell me that what the biggest transition you think has been going from the military to academia? Is there a story that you have that sort of shows exactly how you had to kind of go from one world to another that you could share with us?
It took me a while to realize what was going on, but it's really an attempt to try to get people to understand and appreciate life. So many people, I think, just go through life and they don't really have those answers to the big questions of who we are and why we're here and things like that. And taking all these courses really helps put things into perspective as far as your role in the world in which you live. And I was thinking about how valuable that is. Personally, I feel like I've already kind of cheated death once. I'm really glad to be here, and I'm on borrowed time, and I'm trying to make the most out of everything.
May I tell a story about Samuel that picks up on that?
Absolutely.
Without trying to embarrass him, but he's studying Arabic here, and he studied this summer at Georgetown and to do some advanced Arabic, and he was quoted in a story I read last year about some of his blood on a street over in Iraq, and he would like to be involved in some ways to make certain of that, that other young men and young women don't have the same experience. And that, to me, is worth every minute of this. It sort of underlines what it is that we're trying to do here, and he's just a remarkable example of it.
Hmm. Arabic and Middle East history, that's what you're studying, Samuel?
Yes, ma'am.
Why did you choose those courses?
While I still stand behind what I did in the military, and I don't look upon my service with regret or anything like that. I was really going over to that part of the world under the worst of possible circumstances. I really, really believe in some of the core values that they tried to instill in us in the Marine Corps of defending the defenseless and helping the helpless and things like that. And I really felt that's what we were doing, you know, for all the horrible things that are occasionally reported in the media, there's 100 things behind that of us helping people out over there, people that have never had any support. And it didn't just end because I left there for me. Because I'm not in a uniform anymore doesn't mean that I can't help out anymore. And there are certainly people over there that are in dire need, and you know, someone's got to help them.
Former Marine Samuel Crist is a veteran of the Iraq War who is in his second year at Dartmouth. He's one of 9 veterans from the Iraq and Afghanistan wars now attending the college. We also spoke with James Wright, president of Dartmouth College, himself a former Marine, who's working to encourage veterans to return to school, any school, not just Dartmouth. Thanks for speaking with us today.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, gay marriage, gambling, and other issues before voters next Tuesday. That's tomorrow. We'll be back after the news. Here and Now. An update now from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where legal proceedings against detainees continue, even though the future of the war crimes court is uncertain. The second war crimes trial at Guantanamo Bay is scheduled to begin at the U.S. Navy base this week. And the Pentagon is making plans to bring relatives of the victims of the September 11th attacks to the base to watch a hearing in another case in December. Carol Rosenberg of the Miami Herald joins us from Guantanamo Bay. And Carol, we understand that there are questions about when the second trial might start, but who is the defendant and what is he charged with?
The fellow's name is Ali Hamza Balul, and he's a Yemeni accused of being an Al-Qaeda propagandist. They identify him as Osama bin Laden's media secretary, and he's accused of being a terrorist for creating videos that recruited to Al-Qaeda.
Have you seen the video?
The video's on the web. The video is a homemade splice job of news footage that you would have seen on CNN mixed with speeches from Osama bin Laden and some pretty basic special effects. It's a web-based video called The Destruction of the USS Cole, and the accusation is this was used to get recruits to Al-Qaeda training camps in Afghanistan.
Are there any lessons to be learned from the first trial there? That was the trial of Salim Hamdan. He was also from Yemen, and he was Osama bin Laden's driver. Can you remind us what's his status right now and what happened there?
The most important lesson from the Hamdan trial is that these cases are built on the confessions that the agents, the American agents, got from these guys in interrogation. There is no right against self-incrimination in this military commission. So in the Hamdan trial, he was convicted of being Osama bin Laden's driver and captured in Afghanistan. He told a series of interrogators that he worked as Osama bin Laden's $200 a month driver, but he didn't think he was a war criminal. And they used that at his trial. So I think we'll expect the same sort of thing in Bahlul. Confessions, FBI agents talking about confessions they extracted from him from Afghanistan to Guantanamo. And in the case of Hamdan, he was convicted of providing material support for terror, acquitted of the conspiracy charge by a military jury, military officers, and they sentenced him to serve time out for the rest of the year and be let go at the end of the calendar year.
The Pentagon is appealing that, right?
The Pentagon prosecutor wanted 30 years. They said he was, you know, an Al-Qaeda insider and integral to the organization, and they asked that military jury for 30 years. They came back with 66 months, including time served, which would have let him out by New Year's Eve. And the Pentagon says they had no right to give him time served. They want that sentence vacated. They want to bring the jury back and have them resentence him.
Tell us about the plan to bring some of the family members of 9/11 victims to Cuba to watch a hearing in another case and what that case is.
Yeah, that's the big September 11th trial. That's the trial that seeks the military execution of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the man who's confessed to being the mastermind, the arch plotter of the September 11th attacks, and four other alleged co-conspirators. That trial won't happen until next year, but the Pentagon has been trying to figure out how to get September 11th families down here, mothers and kids and siblings and spouses of people killed in the Trade Center of the Pentagon in Pennsylvania. And they last week announced that there's going to be a lottery. They're going to allow five people at a time to come down, sit in the courtroom, and watch the proceedings. And they've asked those people who qualify to submit to this lottery, and they'll pull names. They're going to implement it for the first time December 8th when they have another pretrial hearing.
And why? Why do it?
The prosecutors feel that these are distant and remote trials, that they want to connect with the American people, that victims have a right to watch, and I think they want to connect these trials to the American people. I mean, we're down here in Guantanamo. They've refused to broadcast them. There's no footage. You won't hear audio from the trials, so all you have is writers. And there's a sense that the people who were victimized by these events have a right to watch. Even for just a week. I mean, they're not offering gavel-to-gavel viewing for the family members. It's more like, you know, a taste. Come down on a military plane, sleep in officers' quarters, eat in the mess, and get a glimpse of the war court. They're hoping that by doing this, they're going to meet some sort of needs by the family members to see what kind of justice is going on down here.
And now you've written about one person who did apply for the Pentagon Guantanamo Visitors Program, and she's an anti-war activist. Is that right?
Is she ever? She's interested in coming because she doesn't trust the system. She would like to see any trials take place in New York. She's a New Yorker, and her son was a firefighter at the World Trade Center that day, and she's against the death penalty and has been in opposition of Guantanamo's indefinite detention. She says she wants trials and justice, but she's not been comfortable with the detention system that the Bush administration has set up. So she's a bit of an activist, and she's applied, but she wonders that whether she's going to be accepted since she has said that she's opposed to the death penalty.
And she's Adele Welty.
Mrs. Welty. And the Pentagon says that Mrs. Welty's name will be put in the pools like anyone else and pulled from a lottery, and that your opinion on the death penalty won't matter. But she's concerned that because she's an activist, she might not be as eligible as someone who maybe supports the war court.
You know, both presidential candidates, John McCain and Barack Obama, have said that they would close Guantanamo Bay if they're elected. But is there, do you think, a possibility that these trials may be moved to the U.S., since that's been a proposal, at least from Senator Obama?
Senator Obama would hold different kinds of trials. He would hold the kind of trial that Mrs. Welty wants, which is in a federal court. He would switch it out of the war court, and he said that he would look at the different cases and see which would require what the court martial, which would require regular federal trials. Senator McCain, he helped write the law that created this court. He wants to close Guantanamo too because he thinks, like Senator Obama, that it has really hurt America's reputation internationally. But he wants to keep the court. He would just perhaps stage the trials somewhere else. Same military commissions, military officers as jurors and judges, and says that, you know, they don't get a regular court. They're not entitled to American due process because they were captured overseas and they're enemy combatants. So there's a division between these two candidates, but it is possible that whoever wins these commissions and Guantanamo will go away.
And how many detainees are at Guantanamo right now? Remind us.
There are 255 men here. Many of them held for 7 years. There are about 18 who are facing charges through this war court. There are some who have been cleared to leave, who are no longer, you know, considered enemy combatants who need to be locked up here. The Pentagon says that at most they would try 80 of the 255 men for war crimes.
All right. Well, Carol Rosenberg of the Miami Herald speaking to us from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Carol, thanks very much.
Thank you, Deb.
Just a reminder, you can listen to today's show stream live on our website, or you can download a podcast and take us with you wherever you go. That's here-now.org. It's Here and Now. The next time you order your coffee at Starbucks, you might want to ask yourself, are you contributing to the global economic downturn? Well, Daniel Gross says maybe. Gross is the Moneybox columnist for Slate and business columnist for Newsweek, and he's proposing what he calls the Starbucks theory of international economics. And Dan, what is this theory?
Well, you remember Tom Friedman had his theory about McDonald's, you know, that the two countries that had McDonald's would never go to war because it was a sign they had a mass-consuming class and these types of countries don't go to war. I have a kind of opposite theory, which is that if you look at what's happened in the global economy, you know, the countries that have been most connected to the U.S. financial system, the ones whose banks were getting involved in subprime and doing all this funky stuff, the ones who are most connected and mimicking the U.S. style of capitalism are those that have had the most problems. So, you know, Great Britain, Western Europe, et cetera. And those countries that have nothing to do with the U.S. financial system, like sub-Saharan Africa, they have not had to have bank bailouts. And so I thought, you know, what's a good proxy for that type of connectedness? What is a good metaphor for, you know, mimicking the U.S. style of highly caffeinated go-go capitalism? And, you know, you spend some time on the Starbucks store locator and you realize maybe the, you know, presence of many, many Starbucks outlets in a nation's financial capital is a pretty good indicator that, you know, they were doing the same sorts of stuff, not just spending $4 for a cup of coffee, but, you know, staying up late, powered by all that caffeine and doing deals and investing in subprime debt and generally engaging in reckless behavior.
Hmm. So basically go-go capitalism, is that what you think a Starbucks symbolizes?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Starbucks, it was, I think, kind of two things in this decade. You know, they had this reckless expansion. It was connected to the housing boom because wherever a new housing development went up, a Starbucks would soon to follow. And it was also a financial boom because they really carpet bombed, you know, every financial district in every major city, especially in New York, where there are literally hundreds of Starbucks, and you would see the investment bankers and their assistants running in and out with, you know, many dollars worth of highly caffeinated beverages. This is what really fueled a great deal of this credit boom that we just went through. Mm.
But there are flaws, obviously, just as there are flaws in Tom Friedman's theory. Obviously, the Russia-Georgia conflict showed that Friedman's McDonald's theory didn't exactly work. They both have McDonald's. They did, of course, attack each other. And what about Iceland? No Starbucks in Iceland. So
right.
There are huge financial problems there. So what happened there?
Well, this theory was offered with tongue firmly in cheek. So if you go, it hold, you know, London had like three, had more Starbucks than Manhattan has. It blew up. South Korea, very heavy concentration. But yes, Iceland was a tiny country, 300,000 people. It's had the worst blow up. It didn't have a single Starbucks. Moscow, again, had a pretty big blow up, only five or six. So this is not by any means a foolproof scenario here.
And Paris in France, right? 35 Starbucks there. Does that mean that Paris is doing somewhat better than the English?
No, I think that's a pretty high concentration. You know, the French have always been a little slow to get up on kind of global capitalism. So that's a pretty high concentration. And, you know, the other amazing thing that to me a concentration of Starbucks represents, especially in these countries, you know, Vienna, Austria, I was just in Istanbul where they have 70 Starbucks, Madrid. These are all countries with very proud and long traditions of a domestic coffee culture. I mean, one of the reasons we opened so many Starbucks in the United States is that we didn't really have this coffee house, cafe culture. But all these places that have been opening tons of Starbucks, they have a centuries-long tradition of their own really good coffee. And to me, what that indicates is a type of bubble mentality and a willingness to kind of overthrow the long-accepted ways of doing businesses and trying to kind of adopt this American thing wholesale. And when you do that with coffee and when you do that with mortgage lending, you get the same result.
Okay. Dan Gross, Moneybox columnist for Slate and business columnist for Newsweek. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Happy to do it.
The writer, Eve LaPlante, doesn't have to look far to find subjects for her books. She merely plucks the fruit of her family tree. Her book, American Jezebel, tells the story of Anne Hutchinson, LaPlante's 11th great-grandmother. Hutchinson was banished from the Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1637 and later co-founded a colony in Rhode Island. LaPlante's latest book recently won the 2008 Massachusetts Book Award for Nonfiction. It's called Salem Witch Judge, The Life and Repentance of Samuel Sewall, who is LaPlante's sixth great-grandfather. Samuel Sewall was the only judge to apologize for condemning 20 people to death during the witch trials in 1692. Today, we're revisiting a conversation that Here and Now's Alex Ashlock had with Eve LaPlante last October. They met near the Sewall family tomb in the old Granary Burial Ground in Boston.
When I was a small child, I used to go out to the tip of Cape Cod to visit my great-aunt Charlotte, who died in 1980. She was a very colorful figure. She was, a Victorian spinster. She wore stockings and a dress even to the beach. And she would regale me with tales of all of our famous and infamous ancestors. And her favorite ancestor was the Salem witch judge. She would tell me what a great man he was, and he loved his children. He was a great lover of music.
He loved to sing.
He loved to sing. He loved to sing the Psalms, I now know. And it didn't quite square with a Salem witch judge, what I knew as a child of that, which seemed quite evil. And then the most colorful thing she told me was after he realized he'd made this terrible mistake at Salem in 1692, he put on a coarse sackcloth for the rest of his life, which rubbed against his skin to remind him of his sin, and he was buried in it. This is basically the story I had in my mind until I was about 40 years old and I started to go back and try to understand why my Aunt Charlotte had loved this man and what might be appealing about him.
Was there a particular case or a particular execution that led him to that moment of repentance?
Of the 20 executions that the court ordered, 14 women and 6 men, 2 of the men were actually Sewall's friends and peers. One was John Alden Jr., who actually escaped the Boston jail and lived. But the other was the Reverend George Burroughs. He had been in the class of 1670 at Harvard. He was a friend of Sewall's, who was in the class of 1671. They were buddies, and he was pulled down from Maine by the court, and he was questioned, and he was convicted, and he was hanged in August of 1692. And as he was about to die on the gallows, the Reverend George Burroughs recited the Lord's Prayer, and the crowd, believing that a witch, or a wizard in this case, could not correctly pray, assumed that he would make a mistake, and he recited it flawlessly. So the crowd started to buzz, and Cotton Mather had to quiet them and shout, "The devil may appear among us as an angel of light." The same day, Sewall wrote in his diary, quote, "This day George Burroughs, John Willard, John Proctor, Martha Carrier, and George Jacobs were executed at Salem. They all said they were innocent." Then, referring to a private conversation with Increase Mather, Samuel reassured himself, "Mr. Mather says they died by a righteous sentence." But Samuel was sorry to have heard that Mr. Burroughs, by his speech, prayer, and protestation of his innocence, did much move unthinking persons. And then in the margins, he added the words, "doleful witchcraft."
There's another scene in the book and in Samuel Sewall's life that takes place right here at the tomb. And this is after the death of one of his daughters. So many of his children died.
Yes, this is 4 years after the Salem witch hunt. It's late December of 1696. His little 2-year-old Sarah is sick, as many of his babies were, with convulsions. And he asked the minister to come pray with his daughter, and there was public prayer. The little girl went to bed with Samuel and his wife Hannah that evening, and a nurse ministered to her through the night. At dawn the next morning, while Samuel Sewall and his wife were sleeping, Sarah gave up the ghost in the nurse's arms. "Dear little Sarah dies," Samuel reported. Thinking of his own inattention, he added, "I thought of Christ's words in the Garden of Gethsemane to Peter and his other disciples, 'Could you not watch with me 1 hour?'" Then the family prays together. His son, Sam Jr., reads the Gospel of Matthew, the 7th verse. Samuel is overcome with remorse because he has condemned the guiltless. "This verse," he wrote, "did awfully bring to mind the Salem tragedy. which he had been going over in his own mind. On Christmas, which the Puritans did not observe, at the burial, the family gathered, and then afterwards they all went home. Samuel then goes back alone to this tomb where we're standing now. Alone, he stands in the tomb meditating on death, where he's entertained with a view of and conversation with the coffins of, he says, my dead father Hull, mother Hull, cousin Quincy, and my six children. Samuel Sewall found this experience of communion with his dead relatives an awful yet pleasing treat. The Lord knows, he said, who shall be brought hither next. And at this point in his life, he's just about to make his public repentance for Salem.
And so 2 weeks later, he does repent, and there's this extraordinary scene which you write about in the book, and also there's a mural of in the Massachusetts State House near where we are, where he repents and the minister reads his repentance. Just tell me a little bit about that event.
It was January 14th, 1697. It was bitterly cold, and it was a fast day because they were feeling that things were not going well in the colony. They're gathered at the church, and the Reverend Samuel Willard read out for the congregation Samuel Sewall's note. It's actually strange because it's in the third person. It said, Samuel Sewall is, upon many accounts, more concerned than any he knows of, a reference to the other Salem witch judges and perhaps some other leading men. And he desires to take the blame and shame of it, that is, the Salem witch hunt, asking pardon of men and desiring prayers that God would pardon that sin and all other of his sins. He's doing something that no one else involved in that event in 1692 had done, and his chief judge, William Stoughton, still thought was wrong and felt that no one should take the blame.
So many years later, what do you think this story tells us today? Why does it resonate with you?
I think it's very compelling to see someone who's high up, who makes a mistake, and rather than falling, which is sort of classic tragedy, turns and becomes a better person. But I think right now we have a sense of perhaps similar to what the Puritans felt, that there's sin or wrongdoing in our world, and we may have the power to change it, but we also have to have the kind of change of heart that Samuel Sewall had. Powerful people don't tend to do what he did, and that makes him stand out. And he did it at some risk to himself. I mean, the story of Salem now is really a story of the witches being heroic, and there's no question about that. In fact, they're not witches. The so-called witches, those who were hanged, were the only ones who would not confess that they were allied with Satan. So it was the people who said, I'm allied with Satan, who went home. So the so-called witches are those noble souls who wouldn't say that. And they're already heroic, but this is an interesting story, sort of turning the history over and then saying, isn't it ironic that this man who's a Salem witch judge wrote an early treatise calling for the right of women, which was completely ignored and has been out of print since 1724. It's in the back of my book. I think it's a very compelling story. He's also turns out to be a pretty lovable guy. After all, my Aunt Charlotte was right.
Eve LaPlante, author of Salem Witch Judge, The Life and Repentance of Samuel Sewall. She spoke with Here and Now's Alex Ashlock. Her book comes out in paperback next month. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.